Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist, and he specializes in pain and palliative care, and also serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken Miller welcomes Dr. Harry Deshpande to talk about head and neck cancers. Dr. Deshpande is an assistant professor of medical oncology and co-director of the Head and Neck Cancer Program at Yale Cancer Center.
So I want to talk about, or we want to talk tonight about head and neck cancer, which is a topic that I think a lot of people don't know very much about. What does that mean? What types of cancer develop in the head and neck?
Head and neck cancers really are cancers that are in the mouth all the way down to the lungs. So we don't include cancer of the brain, even though obviously the brain is in the head. But head and neck cancers tend to be what we call squamous cell cancers. I would say probably over 90% of the time they're that type of cancer cell. And what they are cancers of the lining of the mouth and the throat and the larynx. And they tend to be cancers that grow in that area before spreading to other areas, which they do, but only at a very late stage.
Now, when people hear that a neighbor or a friend or a cousin has cancer, they have breast cancer or lung cancer or colon cancer, how's that different? Is that a squamous cell cancer or is that a different type?
That usually is a different type. That is something called an adenocarcinoma. And they tend to also behave slightly differently in that sometimes lung cancers and colon cancers may not be detected until they've already spread to different areas. Whereas head and neck cancers, because they affect your speech and swallowing, tend to present quite early on and therefore are picked up usually, hopefully, in earlier stages.
So it sounds like it's a different type of cell arising in a different place and with a different biology to it.
That's correct, yes.
What are the symptoms that would bring a patient? You were saying a little bit about, but I mean, why would a patient come to see you or see an ear, nose, and throat doctor?
And you're correct. Usually they see the ear, nose, and throat doctor, or really they see their primary doctor first of all. And usually it's symptoms such as a sore throat or a hoarse voice that really hasn't got better despite antibiotics. And in general, if you have someone who has risk factors for head and neck cancer, whose symptoms don't improve after a couple of weeks or a month, really they need to see their ENT doctor to have more investigations done.
So along those lines, I mean, you say a person with risk factors, well, what are they?
They are mainly, these days, cigarette smoking and alcohol. And it seems that the combination of the two is important. So as opposed to lung cancer, where cigarette smoking is by far the main cause of that cancer, in head and neck cancer, we tend to see it more in people who both smoke and drink alcohol heavily.
For a social, I mean, what we'll call a social drinker, but someone who drinks, let's say, a glass of wine now or then, is that person at risk?
Not as far as we know. They really have to smoke cigarettes heavily as well. And there are other risk factors which seem to be much less important. So things like family history, which accounts for a very, very small percentage of the disease, and a virus called the human papillomavirus, or HPV, which seems to be increasing in incidence, whether that's because fewer people are smoking or whether it really is increasing in incidence, we really don't know at this time.
Now, is that we talk about cervical cancer being associated with HPV, human papillomavirus. Is that the same type of virus?
It seems to be the same type of virus, that's correct. But we don't know why some people will develop head and neck cancer, even though we find human papillomavirus in many people. Only some of those will go on to develop head and neck cancer, but it does appear to be the same type of virus.
Which is really fascinating. I guess it makes me hopeful, too, that perhaps some of the vaccines that would work for, to prevent cervical would prevent head and neck. Is there any data on that yet?
There's a little bit of data, not very much. At last year's annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, there are a couple of abstracts, in other words, experiments presented on human papillomavirus and vaccines. But so far, there haven't been the huge studies that have been done in cervical cancer that have really shown a very, very good benefit. My own feeling is that probably we won't see as much of a benefit because most of head and neck cancers are still from cigarette smoking and alcohol, and it's just a small minority that's from human papillomaviruses. So in order to see a benefit, you would have to treat many, many people with the HPV-associated cancer before you see a difference.
That's a good point. So cervical cancer is such a high prevalence of the virus that you really can have a bigger impact and see it quicker.
That's correct.
All right. So I guess it's a reminder, and so I'll sort of share this, take the opportunity to say, please stop smoking and have your relatives stop smoking.
Yes, definitely.
Harry, along those lines, for people that that have been smokers, if someone's out there and says, "Well, why bother to quit? Because I've got that risk already." Let me ask you that question: if someone quits, will their risk of head and neck cancer begin to drop?
It definitely will drop. In fact, we know that even if they develop the cancer, with head and neck cancer, it's possible to remove a lot of these cancers, even if they are at a fairly advanced stage. But if they don't stop smoking, their risk of the cancer coming back is over double the risk of someone who does stop smoking. So it definitely will go down whether or not they develop the cancer.
All right. So this is a great opportunity. I want to focus in on this. So for someone who's been treated for the cancer successfully,
yes,
if they continue to smoke, what are their risks as opposed to if they were to say, "Doc, I that's it, I'm done with smoking"?
Well, they have two main risks. They have a risk of a recurrence of their head and neck cancer, and they also have a risk of what we call a second primary cancer, which usually will occur in the lung, but it could be anywhere that smoking-related cancers occur. And the risk of recurrence is probably somewhere close to 10% in someone who continues to smoke. So it's not insignificant. And it may even be higher. It's very difficult to collect that data. Certainly, if they stop smoking, it could be as low as 3%. So it's a real difference compared to if people stop smoking or if they continue to smoke.
Harry, in your practice, I mean, you're working with a group of people that many or most of whom have been smokers and may have been drinking heavily. I mean, have you can you think of a number of success stories where people have quit?
Most people, actually, I'm happy to say, do stop smoking. I think they hear it's from so many people, mm-hmm. whether it's the nurses or the medical assistants or the physicians. And they're very, very motivated to stop. There are, unfortunately, a few people who do continue to smoke, and I have seen some of those people develop second cancers, which is very unfortunate, really.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about two related topics. I mean, one is if someone has symptoms, how is the diagnosis made? And the second part of it would be, it's somewhat related, after someone's been treated, how do you monitor them?
If the first question, usually they do see their primary doctor, and occasionally the primary doctor will see a lump on the neck of that patient. And that could mean that one of the lymph nodes in the neck is affected. And that's not an uncommon way that the diagnosis is made. Often at that stage, either the primary doctor or a radiologist can put a small needle in there and make the diagnosis. Usually, however, the symptoms will be a sore throat or a change in the voice or a problem swallowing. And then the ENT physician will have to make the diagnosis by putting something called a fiber optic laryngoscope, which is a small flexible telescope that goes down as far as the larynx, and they can see exactly what's going on.
Okay, so it would be a biopsy of some kind to establish
exactly
the diagnosis.
Yes.
How about CAT scans, MRIs? What tools do you use from...
CAT scans and MRIs are used usually to determine the stage of the disease. And by the stage, I mean we usually stage diseases in cancer in a uniform way using something called the TNM system, where T stands for the size of the tumor, N stands for the lymph nodes, whether or not they're involved, and M is whether the cancer has metastasized or spread to other areas. And head and neck cancer staging is slightly different from the staging of other cancers. For instance, most cancers are staged in four stages, where stage four means the cancer has spread all over the body. Now, stage four for a head and neck cancer could mean one of three things. Either it spread to many lymph nodes in the neck, or the cancer itself is very large, or it could mean that it spread over the body. So two of those stage fours, if you like, stage 4A and stage 4B, are technically still treatable and often curable by either surgery or radiation alone.
So for other types of cancer, let's say lung cancer or breast cancer, stage 4 would mean you probably wouldn't operate. But with head and neck cancer, even with stage 4, some of those patients can still have surgery.
That's correct, yes, especially the stage 4A cancer patients. In fact, the whole staging system was changed about 6 years ago to create this new stage 4A category, if you like, to determine which patients could still be treated with an operation. And I did say surgery or radiation alone. I meant surgery or radiation as the primary modality, with chemotherapy as an adjunct to that.
For patients who've had head and neck cancer, let's say they have surgery for a stage 1 or 2 or 3 or perhaps even 4. In terms of not so much the treatment, but the monitoring afterwards, because again, some of these patients are at risk for recurrence or for a new cancer developing because of smoking or alcohol. How do you monitor? I mean, what do you recommend in terms of monitoring?
We usually see those patients every 3 months, and the ENT physician, that's usually either Dr. Sasaki or Dr. Ross, will also see them as well. And they will have physical exams just like anyone at a primary doctor's office, and also a fiber optic laryngoscopy exam from the ENT physician. But we also tend to do CAT scans every 3 to 6 months. And that's because sometimes we can pick up small lymph nodes or small tumors in the aerodigestive tract, as we call it, or the lymph nodes in the neck much earlier than we can detect them by feeling that area.
Yeah, I want to go back also to the point you made too, which is that people are at risk to develop other cancers, especially if they're still smoking. So I think sounds like that's your opportunity to find a new cancer if it were developed earlier.
That's correct. And we usually do a scan or a chest X-ray, a CAT scan of the chest, to look for those second primary cancers.
Well, we'd like to remind you that you can email your questions to us and Dr. Harry Deshpande at Yale Cancer Answers. At canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about head and neck cancer with Dr. Harry Deshpande from the Yale Cancer Center.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2008, there will be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients are diagnosed annually here in Connecticut alone. Now, while melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Dr. Harry Deshpande, who is an expert in the treatment of head and neck cancer at the Yale Cancer Center. Harry, one of the terms that's used a lot is multidisciplinary care. Boy, I'm getting tongue-tied today. But what does that mean in terms of patients who come with a cancer of the head or neck?
What it means is that many different physicians are going to see that patient and come up with a plan that is the general consensus of all of those physicians. And that's very, very important in, I think, all cancers, but especially in head and neck cancer, where surgeons and radiation oncologists and medical oncologists have to work very, very closely together to come up with a good plan. And what's unique about the head and neck cancer team is that, like many other cancers, we have what's known as a tumor board meeting where we all meet and discuss patients. But at the head and neck cancer multidisciplinary tumor board, which is quite a mouthful, we do have the patients come into the room itself. And it may be a little daunting for some patients, but they appreciate it knowing that all the physicians are seeing them at once and coming up with a plan. And we get to see the films and sometimes even see a video of the laryngoscopy, which is very, very important.
So the patient's there for this discussion.
They are there, that's right.
I have to say, that's unique.
Yes.
It really is. So, and do they get to hear the discussion?
They hear part of the discussion. We can ask them questions. Obviously, we have 1 hour to see 6 or 7 patients, so we tend to have part of the discussion behind closed doors, if you like, and then part in front of the patient. And then at the end of the tumor board meeting, one of us, either Dr. Sasaki or myself, will go out to them and explain what the findings of the meeting
have said. It sounds like it's truly a wonderful approach. So let me throw out a scenario to you where the whole team might be involved. It used to be that if a patient had cancer of the voice box, the larynx, that they would lose their voice. And now there's a lot of talk about organ preservation, larynx preservation. So again, how might in terms of treating that patient with a cancer of the larynx, how might the whole team be involved?
That's a very good example, because I think any of 3 different approaches can be used. If the cancer is very, very small, then sometimes they can use what's known as preservation surgery. In other words, either using a laser or different surgical techniques, they can remove the cancer still without removing the larynx. They can also use radiation therapy alone if it's very, very small. If it's bigger, then they tend, first of all, to use a combination of radiation and chemotherapy and still hopefully preserve the larynx. So the patients will not need a tracheostomy, which is the hole in the neck, and they will be able to still talk. Now, obviously, some people, these approaches don't work, and they will end up needing the larynx to be removed. But even in those patients, we have an excellent speech and swallow department within the ENT department, and they can often have people train in different ways of speaking. One of the ways is to use a vibrating device that's put against the neck that allows them to make sounds, and really some people are able to talk very well using that.
Now, one of the new advances that is happening in cancer in general are targeted therapies. Do you have what targeted therapies? In other words, therapies that really hone right in on the cancer. What therapies that do you have in head and neck cancer that are new or helpful?
We have one in particular, which is called Erbitux or cetuximab. Head and neck cancer, as I mentioned earlier, is usually something called a squamous cell cancer. And those cancers tend to have on their surface a lot of proteins, which we term receptors, and they will attract various things in the blood. And one of them is called an EGFR, or an epidermal growth factor receptor, and it attracts various proteins, one of which is the epidermal growth factor. Okay. And what we know about those cancers is those receptors are very prevalent on the surface of the cancer cell, but not so present on other cells in the body. So if you can target those particular receptors, then in theory you can treat those cancers. It's not quite as easy as that because they are obviously present on some other cells, especially in the skin. But what we found is the side effects tend to be a little different with these treatments rather than traditional chemotherapy.
Now, do you use this medicine Erbitux, do you use it by itself? Do you use it with chemotherapy, with radiation?
We tend to use it mainly with radiation. It seems to be what we call a very potent radiosensitizer. In other words, if patients get radiation by themselves or if they get radiation with Erbitux, they tend to do much, much better in terms of survival and actual treating the cancer if Erbitux is added to the radiation. And the nice thing is they don't seem to get the side effects that they would get if we added chemotherapy to the radiation.
Harry, you talked some about surgery really having a very prominent role in treatment of head and neck cancers. How would you make the decision whether to use chemotherapy either preoperatively or postoperatively for a patient who's coming to the tumor board? What would lean you one way or the other?
I think that's an excellent question. I think these days, head and neck cancer, as well as other cancers, are beginning to incorporate chemotherapy much earlier in their treatment. With head and neck cancer, we tend to use chemotherapy up front only if we're going to use radiation afterwards. And that's mainly because if you give someone chemotherapy for a head and neck cancer, the surgeon then finds it very difficult to see where the margins are. We can often make the cancers get much, much smaller, but the surgeons don't know where to finish cutting, if you like.
Okay.
So we don't tend to use it before an operation, but we do use it before radiotherapy.
Very interesting. What are some clinical trials that you're involved in and excited about here at the Yale Cancer Center?
We have one clinical trial using a combination of two different chemotherapies, one which was developed at Yale over the years called mitomycin C, along with a pill called capecitabine in combination with radiation. That trial should be coming to a close soon. But we also have a lot of trials in a different type of head and neck cancer, if you like, thyroid cancer, which I haven't talked about so much.
Well, so it's a perfect segue. Harry, you're truly an expert when it comes to thyroid cancer. So tell us about that in terms of, you know, some of the new developments.
Well, thyroid cancer is really a disease by itself if you consider head and neck cancers as a whole. It doesn't behave like the squamous cell cancers. It's much rarer for a start. And it tends to have a much, much better prognosis. So you'll often hear people say, if you're going to get a cancer, thyroid cancer is one to get. And they, in the past, have not had to see medical oncologists. They're usually treated with operations and something called radioiodine. But there are many different types of thyroid cancer. There's at least four different categories that we tend to put thyroid cancers in. And they tend to be treated in very different ways. For instance, the papillary and follicular thyroid cancers are treated with surgery and a radioiodine preparation. Medullary cancers come from a different cell type, and they tend to be treated with surgery and traditional radiotherapy. And then there's a terrible disease called anaplastic thyroid cancer, which until recently has not been able to be treated with any kind of treatment.
All right, so let me ask you about anaplastic, because I know that's an area you have a lot of expertise. What are you working on?
Well, we have a clinical trial at Yale using a new agent called CA4P, or combretastatin, which is a new class of medicine called a vascular disrupting agent. There's been a lot of trials on different kinds of ways of attacking cancers. And one of the ways is to try and attack the blood supply of the cancer. And we know that agents which are called vascular endothelial growth factor agents or antibodies are very effective in colon cancer and breast cancer. But this new agent actually seems to stop the blood getting through those new blood vessels. If you like it, will cause congestion in that blood vessel. Interestingly, it was originally found from the bark of an African willow tree, and it was used in the spears of the Zulu tribes. So if you use it in too high quantities, it's not a good thing, because they used it as a poison, obviously.
Yes.
But I think we found a way of using it properly.
Which sounds actually what a novel, wonderful thing to take something that was first a poison and then to use it against cancer.
It's just amazing how it was found. I can't take any credit for that.
For patients who are treated with this drug, and I'm going to ask you to say the name again, so if they're, what kind of results are you seeing?
Well, the name is Combretastatin. I'm hopeful the company will come up with a better name in the future. But so far, it is actually brand new. In this particular trial, there's only two patients in the country that have been treated, and one of those has been at Yale. We're screening another patient now. And so far, we have amazingly seen a stabilization of the disease. Now, this is a disease that usually runs rampant within a few weeks or months. So even a stable disease is a good response.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it goes to the concept of, at least for some patients, I mean, obviously for all patients, we'd love to get rid of the cancer, but also to be able to live with cancer as a chronic disease.
That's correct.
Yeah. In terms of other therapies for thyroid cancer, since we're on that topic, it sounds again like this is a multidisciplinary kind of approach.
It is. The thyroid group here at Yale, headed by Dr. Udelsman and Dr. Sosa, who are the thyroid surgeons, is very, very active. And as I mentioned, I often don't see those patients because they do so well just with surgery alone or surgery plus radioiodine. But with those unfortunate patients who the disease has spread widely or they have anaplastic cancer, then we do have a meeting once a week with the surgeons and the nurses and the research assistants. And once again, it's a whole team that comes up with an approach for that particular person.
Actually, I have to say, it's very exciting that there's some of the new drugs available. And I also want to say, too, I think it's, let me ask a question. Those patients with thyroid cancer, do they also come to this multidisciplinary tumor board?
They don't come to that tumor board. They are treated in the endocrine, or they are seen through the endocrine tumor board, which is a different area in Yale. In some institutions, head and neck cancer tumor boards will include thyroid cancer. Here, because we're a referral center, we have enough people to see in a separate tumor board.
Well, I'd say very exciting and very interesting, and I want to thank you for joining us on Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Thank you very much.
And from myself and our staff with the Yale Cancer Center Answers, we want to wish all of you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, you can go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, you'll learn about drug development and clinical trials.